from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the expected and unexpected consequences of the drought, how the lack of rain is affecting agriculture, schools, and politicians. Also, cultivating young software engineers among the children of Salinas farm workers.
Lucky for us, Silicon Valley is down the street, and there's thousands and thousands of great companies that could offer them careers that they haven't necessarily heard of yet.
Plus, a spicy exhibit in Los Angeles celebrates the cultural impact of hot sauce and counting the heads and tails of Pacific gray whales off the coast of L.A.
We see nursing behavior. We see mating behavior. We've been able to see 20 different species from here, and nobody knew you can actually see that many close to shore. So we're able to find things that nobody really had seen before.
It's the California Report. Well, spring officially arrived this week, and with it a reminder that the rainy season, such as it was, is quickly coming to an end. And rain, or the lack thereof, was the focus of a very heated congressional hearing in Fresno Wednesday. Those protesters on the steps of Fresno City Hall shouting agua, agua, agua underscored the issue being made by Republican members of the House Natural Resources Committee, who arranged that meeting. And joining us now to talk about the drought and its expanding impact is KQED science editor Craig Miller. And Craig, there were a number of drought-related things that happened this week. Help us, if you would, put them in context, would you?
Scott, you know, the impacts of this drought, and we're only just seeing the start of them, can almost be divided into the predictable and the unpredictable. And the congressional hearing in the Valley that you just referred to is kind of in the predictable category. It's Valley Republicans decrying what they like to call the man-made drought or the regulatory drought, meaning that environmental regulations designed to protect the Delta and protect fish are to blame substantially for the lack of water. Here's Devin Nunes, a Republican who represents a district around Fresno.
These extremists won't uproot themselves from their comfortable homes in San Francisco and other coastal cities, but they're more than willing to use the Central Valley communities as a guinea pig to see if our lands can be restored to some mystical state of nature. You see the results of their relentless fight in the new Dust Bowl that has overtaken the valley.
So this is framing the drought as farms versus fish. It's an old drumbeat, and it's one that I think a lot of observers would say is a bit simplistic given California's complex, you know, water picture.
A very much less predictable or anticipated impact of the drought this week played out with State School Superintendent Tom Torlakson touring the Central Valley and some of the school districts there. Describe what he was there to talk about.
Yeah, so this is an example of the unpredictable, I think. Who would have thought? I mean, obviously, if you're close to the situation, you see it happening. But who would have thought that the drought would have such a direct impact on public schools, of all things? But as hundreds of thousands of acres go fallow, which will be happening this year, that means acreage not put into production, farm worker families will leave the towns where they've been.
And maybe leave California.
And maybe leave California altogether for greener pastures, so to speak. Baldomero Hernandez, he's certainly given it a lot of thought. He's superintendent of the Westside Elementary School District down there. Here's how he frames it.
Within a year or two, my school district would be closed, bottom line. With the zero allocation of water, that means next year, 80% of the workforce out there in my area is laid off. It's gone. They're going to leave.
And when they leave, that impacts the school districts directly because their state funding is tied directly to attendance.
And so what can the state, what will the state do about it?
Well, they're working on a plan right now that would allow school districts to maintain their funding at a certain level for a limited period of time, even if students leave. But it's just a temporary fix.
And Craig, something else happened this week, also unexpected and much more bipartisan and more maybe solution-oriented, you might say. Two members of Congress from California, one Democrat, John Garamendi, and a Republican, Doug LaMalfa from Redding, stood up to say that they both supported a major water project here in California, a large reservoir. What's that about?
So that's about seizing the moment. You know, you've been covering politics for a long time, so you're familiar with the time-worn adage that
let no crisis go unused
should,
or taken advantage
waste.
Of.
Exactly, right. So this is the drought as an opportunity to revive some ideas that have been on the table, some of them for years or even decades. And so Garamendi is introducing a bill that would authorize construction of this enormous off-stream reservoir off the Sacramento River, I guess I should say, not on the Sacramento River. But if you go about halfway from Sacramento to Redding and turn left, there's a remote valley over there, which is home currently to a few ranches and a tiny little wide spot on the road hamlet called Sites, S-I-T-E-S, which they're thinking about walling off, basically, so they could pump water out of the Sacramento River when we have, say, a wet winter, filling up that valley and then pump it back into the river when we need it. So it's kind of like if the river is a freeway, this is kind of like the rest area they want to create.
Well, isn't that really out of favor with environmentalists and by extension Democrats?
One of the reasons they like this particular project is because it is, quote, off stream. In other words, there's no need to dam a current waterway, which has huge environmental implications. It may be safe to say that'll never happen again in California. So this is like one of the few alternatives that may actually be workable, but it's hugely expensive.
How expensive?
Well, an estimate back in 2007, that's how long they've been studying this, actually longer, was that it would come in about $3 billion, and there's no funding in the bill.
And so where are they suggesting the funding would come from?
Possibly partly federal money and possibly partly the ultimate beneficiaries of the water would help pay for it.
But a bipartisan idea nonetheless,
that's
which
right.
Is progress. Craig, we did get a fair amount of rain in February. So where do we stand as April approaches here?
In a deep, dry hole, Scott. In January, NOAA, the federal climate guys, declared much of California to be an exceptional drought. This is the worst drought condition that they have on their scale. And it's the first time in the history of the 15-year drought monitor tracking index that they've done. That's the first time they've ever put any part of California in that. About a quarter of the state is in that category right now, and 90% of the state is in at least severe drought or worse.
So the time for denial or hope for a miraculous deluge is pretty much over?
Is over. That's right. We're looking at a long, dry summer ahead.
All right. KQED Science Editor Craig Miller. Craig, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Scott.
Silicon Valley draws thousands of young programmers hoping to strike it rich in the tech industry. Problem is, it's a rather exclusive club, favoring top-notch graduates from prestigious universities. But a new program in the Salinas Valley is challenging that formula by helping the children of farmworking families become programmers and engineers in just 3 years. The California Report's education reporter Anna Tintakala says a lot is on the line for these students and their families.
Rogelio Mendoza is mowing the front lawn outside his family's modest home in Salinas. It's a warm weekday evening, and his wife Norma is inside cooking up dinner for their three boys.
Carne, beans, and some pozole, Mexican pozole. So that's what we're having today.
Norma makes sure to serve her oldest son first, the minute he walks through the door after a long day of classes. Alonso is 21 years old and the first in the family to attend college. He says some days he honestly feels like his head is going to explode with all the schoolwork, but it's way better than farm work.
Working in the fields and having your back hurt, your arms hurt, you can't compare that kind of tired to just like having your mind stressed over homework.
The Mendoza family is a farmworking family. Alonso's dad, Rogelio, has been planting and harvesting in the fields for more than 30 years. Alonso joins his dad during the summers.
You get home, you eat, you don't even want to talk like to nobody. I would just like go to my room and I would just sit down on the floor and I would fall asleep in the floor, like not even my bed. I would just fall asleep in my floor. You wake up and it's already time to go back to work the next day.
That experience motivated Alonzo to graduate high school. He says young people who don't finish school in this town end up working in three places: the mall, fast food, or in the fields.
They don't see like themselves doing something big in life, so they're getting paid $10 an hour. They settle for that.
But Alonzo refuses to settle. About a year ago, he was registering for his classes at Hartnell Community College, the only college in Salinas, when he was tipped off to a brand new program specifically for students of farmworking families. In partnership with Cal State Monterey Bay, Hartnell is promising a bachelor's degree in computer science in just 3 years. He applied and was accepted. His mom, Norma, says it was like winning the lottery.
I say thanks God because he did it himself, so he's going to do great.
For years, the family has been hustling hard to earn more money. Norma tried to make it as a realtor. Rogelio tried construction until the recession hit. They've been living on Rogelio's modest wages ever since.
So the idea was to give our kids like a nice place to live, a nicer house, a nicer future. That's what we thought.
So now the pressure is on Alonzo.
So then you have an empty string, and then so here in range, though, this is going to go to the length minus two. So
Alonzo spends 40 hours or more every week here at Hartnell Community College. He's one of 32 students cramming 4 years of computer science instruction into just three. Instructors here say it's much harder for these kids. Many haven't mastered calculus, a skill needed for this line of work. Others still need help with their English. And then there's the added challenge of having no one at home to help them figure out programming languages and algorithms. Student Daniel Diaz says his dad thought computer science was about fixing computers.
He's like, oh, your cousin tried to do that, but he didn't go anywhere. I'm like, no, Dad, this is not to fix computers. It's to create programs on a computer. So when I'm at home, I'm more like by myself in my room. My mom's always telling me, why are you always in your room on your computer? I'm like, because I'm doing my homework.
It can be isolating. That's why program manager Melvin Jimenez has created support groups.
Having that peer mentorship will help a lot of these students navigate their way through what would otherwise be a very challenging process.
Jimenez's challenge is convincing big-time Silicon Valley tech firms to take a leap of faith and offer these students an internship.
Lucky for us, Silicon Valley is down the street, and there's thousands and thousands of great companies that could offer them careers that they haven't necessarily heard of yet.
The starting salary of a programmer ranges from $50,000 to $80,000 a year, and that's what Alonzo Mendoza is banking on. He really believes this degree will change his family's future, and everybody is doing what they can to help him succeed, including his dad, Rogelio.
Pues el sacrificio de nosotros es venirnos. Tenemos que estar aquí por los hijos para que estudien y todo.
It was a sacrifice to leave Mexico, to come here and work so we can make it better for our kids to study and get a good education. It would be a great help once I stop working in the fields.
Alonzo says in 3 years' time, he hopes to make that a reality.
He might not show it that he's tired, but I know that he's tired. Like he comes home all sweaty, his clothes, his armpits, his back, it's all sweaty. And that's why I want to like be someone successful, because I really do want to help.
The students complete their first year in the program in May. Of the 32 young people who are enrolled, only one has dropped out. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tentakulis in Salinas.
Whale watching out on the ocean is a fun way to spend a few hours, right? Especially now in the middle of migrating season for the Pacific gray whale. But imagine doing it not just one morning or afternoon, but for weeks on end. Well, that's exactly what a group of volunteer researchers in L.A. County does, spending their free time counting the heads and tails of migrating whales for the annual census. Reporter Valerie Hamilton checked in with these citizen scientists in Palos Verdes.
You gotta blow two whales.
Two whales.
There's been a steady stream of gray whales passing through the waters off Palos Verdes since December. And on the cliff above, there's been a steady stream of researchers watching their every move.
Rolling.
Oh, nice.
I saw a peck.
A team of 80 whale watchers take shifts scanning the seas here from sunup till sundown. They're all volunteers, citizen scientists trained to make and record scientific observations. Only one of them is a marine biologist, project leader Elisa Shulman-Janiger.
Many of our people are members of the public who are jogging by one day,
Another day brought binoculars, another day brought a chair, and then they end up as part of that project.
We have a nurse and a musician and an IT person. And I'm
Sheila Parker used to monitor a different kind of traffic as a Los Angeles Highway Patrol officer. Now she spends most of her free time watching the ocean for migrating whales.
Yes, yeah. Right, there's a blow.
There, okay, yeah. Got it.
Everyone here comes from a different background, each with its own skill set. Take Eric Hemian, for example.
I was a lifeguard in New Jersey for 23 years, so I'm very used to just sitting and staring out to sea.
April Ryan trained mammals before in Hollywood.
I did squirrel commercials. I did TV shows with dogs and cats. I was a camel girl in Charlie Wilson's War.
Perhaps the only thing the volunteers all have in common is a passion for watching California's gray whales for hours and hours every week from December to May. Joyce Daniels has been doing it for 2 decades.
If you're here, you're kind of crazy. You know, you're out here in the wind and the rain, and you've got to be crazy.
Gray whales migrate more than 10,000 miles round trip every year between the Arctic and Baja California. That's the sound of a gray whale underwater, recorded by the Scripps Whale Acoustics Lab. It's tricky and expensive to study whales in the ocean. But when gray whales migrate, some of them swim close to the Palos Verdes Peninsula, where researchers can study them from land. The first gray whale census here started in the late 1970s as a project at the Marineland Theme Park. Elisa Shulman-Janiger remembers, as a serious research project, it had its limitations.
Some of our volunteers in Marineland were there, honestly, just to be able to get into Marineland. They would sit with us for a little bit and go off and watch a killer whale show.
She expanded the project to cover the whole migration season, with no budget for scientists or even supplies. Her team's main resource is persistence, and she says it's paid off.
We see nursing behavior, we see mating behavior. We've been able to see 20 different species from here, and nobody knew you can actually see that many close to shore. So we're able to find things that nobody really had seen before.
Over the years, that's put these volunteer naturalists in a position to have an impact on marine science and on conservation.
They were trying to come up with some guidelines on where to put gill nets, and based upon the feedback we gave them, they decided to ban them within 3 miles of shore. So although we are volunteers, we are contributing to science, and we are influencing things such as regulations.
That's part of why volunteers come back year after year, but they all have their own reasons, too.
We love, 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 love to see when the calves go on top of the moms, stick their little faces out, mother hold them up and roll around.
For Sheila Parker, it's the sound of a whale breathing.
When they exhale, it's a hollow, majestic, almost haunting sound. It's kind of like a like breathing through a big pipe, almost. And it's really, really special.
Gray whales in the eastern Pacific were taken off the endangered species list a decade ago, and this year's count so far is the highest in 16 years. Shulman-Janiger says that could be a sign that they're eating well in the Arctic. But, she says, climate change has made their environment fragile, and even a tiny shift could put them back in danger. If that happens, she and her team of citizen scientists may be the first to know. For the California Report, I'm Valerie Hamilton in Palos Verdes.
As the Bay Area tech boom pushes rents higher and higher, big industrial spaces are quickly becoming unaffordable for artists. That's what makes American Steel Studios in West Oakland so unusual. It's become a magnet for all types of artists, sculptors, woodworkers, and especially metalworkers. Reporter Eric Newman paid a visit and brings us this audio postcard.
I'm standing inside an exhibit made by local artist Nick Dong. He calls it the Enlightenment Room. It's a rectangular room the size of a big closet. It's dark inside, and you can barely see the tiny white tiles covering the walls. At one end is a single seat. I sit down. A bright light shines down on my face, and the sound of people chanting gets louder and louder. I sit still for a moment, and then walk out of the room.
You don't have to go to church. You don't have to practice meditation. You can just be in that room. And that room will help you transcend your mind.
The exhibit just came back from Washington, D.C., where it was featured at the Smithsonian Institute's Renwick Gallery. When I left, I didn't quite feel enlightened, but I did feel different. We walked through the massive building to his personal studio. Dong's also a metal worker, and he's hammering a piece of copper for a wall hanging he's making.
When the metal gets hammered, it gets hardened, and it gets less malleable. At that time, we can use torch to heat the metal up. So the metal will go back to its really sort of soft and malleable state.
I walk into a cavernous part of the building. People weld giant sculptures and big trucks drive through. That's where I meet artist Rebecca Anders. She's been at American Steel since 2007.
My training is in metalwork. Sometimes I work in recycled tire, or right now I'm doing some fabric work. I like to think everything's a potential material.
She shows me one of her projects called the horse car. It looks like a big covered wagon, and coming out of the front is a life-size model of a horse's head made out of tires. And it looks surprisingly real.
We built this art car for Burning Man a few years ago. It's got a steel tube frame, and it actually has flame effects shooting out of the nose, which obviously aren't lit right now.
Anders says San Francisco, across the bay, isn't really an option these days for artists like her who need industrial workspaces.
What inspired me to make this happen was the people that started showing up needing a space like this.
American Steel Studios founder Karen Cusolito first rented part of the building in 2005 to build a 30-foot-tall sculpture. Over time, more and more people asked her about the space, and in 2009, she signed a lease on the whole building. Today, about 170 artists use it to produce commercial and public work that can be seen around California and beyond.
These people have amazing skill sets. They have amazing vision and creativity.
And Cusolito says having workspaces like this are what allows the Bay Area to foster the creativity it's known for. For the California Report, I'm Eric Newman in Oakland.
A pair of California-made hot sauces is the main course of a spicy exhibit that opened last week in Los Angeles. L.A. Heat explores the culinary and pop culture impact of sriracha and tapatio, two too-hot-to-handle condiments with very different origins that somehow managed to become unifying ingredients in L.A. culture and cuisine. The California Report's Los Angeles bureau chief, Stephen Cuevas, gives us a little taste.
For some, the appeal starts with the bottle, tapatio and its tapered glass body, slim neck, and red cap. Sriracha, its chubbier relative, made of soft, squishable plastic and simple eye-catching graphics splashed across its belly.
With sriracha, you have the iconic green lid and red bottle, and the tapatio, you have the Mexican cowboy on the label with blue eyes. It's always fascinating. And so those two iconic images, I think, were ripe for artists to explore.
Stephen Wong is interim executive director of the Chinese American Museum in downtown Los Angeles. He handpicked 30 artists to submit pieces for L.A. Heat. Graffiti artist turned designer Sket One appropriated Sriracha's multilingual design scheme and white rooster emblem for a trio of Sketinguishers, fire extinguishers, stripped and repainted, each one now representing a different color of the Mexican flag, and festooned with sriracha-inspired graphics.
They are full, so if we had a fire right now, we could put it out. I did not put sauce inside of them. A lot of people always ask me, and I said, that's not going to be the end result, someone actually picking it up and firing sauce at someone.
That would be pretty awesome,
though. It would be.
And not just any hot sauce, one created 35 years ago in L.A.'s Chinatown by a Vietnamese immigrant inspired by the spicy fish sauce of Southeast Asia. Sriracha would seep into Latino and American diets just as the blue-eyed tapatio cowboy was galloping into the cupboards of Asian kitchens, including Michael Shung's.
You know, you put tapatio on everything, and you put sriracha on everything. And when I put it on pizza, you know, I had people randomly come up to me and be like, oh, I do that too.
Shung's contribution for L.A. Heat is the exhibit's flagship image.
It's a pen and ink drawing of the tapatio main character riding on top of the sriracha rooster, pouring out both sauces on top of a pepperoni pizza. It sounds really strange describing it, but for me at least, equally, you know, they were working together to change, like, the cuisine out here. So,
Tapatio founder and Mexican immigrant Jose Luis Saavedra began selling his hot sauce door-to-door in South L.A. over 40 years ago, eventually expanding across the U.S., Central America, and parts of Europe. Sriracha creator David Tran introduced his blood-red jalapeno sauce in 1980, shortly after fleeing war-torn Vietnam aboard a Panamanian freighter bound for California. Curator Steve Wong says Tran's journey inspired a single-panel mural by Audrey Chen.
He's in the foreground, and in the background is the Hui Fong boat or ship that he immigrated on.
And which Tran named his company after.
In the midground, you have these flying or bombing peppers coming down. It could be also a reference to the current controversy that David is facing with the city of Irwindale.
The maker Sriracha is under fire from neighbors complaining that his Southern California factory is spewing out a foul smell, giving them burning eyes and headaches.
Last year, as described in this story from CBS News, the city of Irwindale sued Hui Fong Foods over complaints that fumes from its factory east of L.A. were making nearby residents ill. The company disputes the claims and is fighting the lawsuit. In video artist Yoshi Sakai's more lighthearted confrontation, called Hot Side Story, dancers in Dayglow, Tapatio, and Sriracha costumes face off against Heinz Ketchup and French's Mustard in a satirical West Side Story-like showdown.
We would celebrate Chinese New Year and Cinco de Mayo and learn the traditional dances. So, you know, I feel like the show is completely aligned with my personal life.
Phuong Huynh is a Vietnamese-American painter who arrived in the U.S. as a toddler around the same time as Sriracha founder David Tran. Her painting, inspired by Shanghai advertisements of the 1930s, is called La.
L-A-H, which also stands for Los Angeles Heat, and La in Chinese means hot. It's spicy, controversial, referring to the whole Sriracha controversy in Irwindale, and also hot to describe somebody who's good-looking or sexy.
The painting depicts cherubic babies riding a pair of strutting Sriracha roosters in the foreground and a close-up of two mixed-race teenage girls, eyes reddened and mascara streaked after overindulging on Sriracha.
It's something that spans cultures and spans age groups and spans just everything.
Artist Sket Wan says the hot sauces have actually become like global culinary ambassadors.
It's kind of what we hope for world peace, I guess. You know, maybe Sriracha will bring some peace.
L.A. Heat, taste-changing condiments, has been slow in garnering attention from Los Angeles art critics, but more than 600 people came through the doors for the exhibit's opening last week at L.A.'s Chinese American Museum. L.A. Heat is on view through July. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Sarah Bond. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Howard Gelman, and Jim Bennett. The online team includes David Weir, Chad McClymans, Lisa Pickoff-White, Olivia Allen-Price, and David Marks. Our interns are Kate Hunt and Matthew Levin. Julia McAvoy was a contributing editor. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Susie Rocho, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2015 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, available at www.irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.